wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is Atlantic Voice Podcast, I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
We are in different studios. My partner is in the new basement studio by the lake, and I'm in our satellite studios by the river.
We're trying out new technology and everything.
Yeah, we're back on sort of...
I'm hopefully sound better than last week. There were some comments, including from senior scientists of the pod, that my audio was poor in the last podcast, which I blame squarely on the technician over on the other end of this line.
Oh, okay. Well, you sound much better today. So I guess by that extension, I should take credit.
Sure.
Okay, there you go. So I take credit for fixing the audio from last time. We actually do these calls.
By the way, I had not listened. You did not tell me that you were running a in-between episode, which was not really about us at all, but rather touting the other media properties of the Atlantic Voice.
Yeah, I talked about that the other week when we'd had that stretch between shows, and I told you I just threw one out and spent most of it just talking about our other pro. We have done shows since that show.
Yeah, I know. I didn't notice until I went back to, because I'm not listening to a lot of podcasts now because I'm working from home, so I wasn't listening to much. And then when I went to go check the audio on that last one, I said, "What is this episode?" And I said, "Oh, Zeph snuck out one of those solo episodes."
I did not intentionally do a solo episode. I wanted to give our fans content. Yeah. And again, if you were busy, because again, we both work, and I know. It is interesting. I don't, we have done coronavirus to death, but I have found I'm actually working harder during coronavirus.
Oh, same here,
man. Do you know what I mean? And so,
yeah, I don't know if it's because of coronavirus. For you, it might be because of the, the issues of dealing with school.
Yes, that's true. Coronavirus has affected my everyday work environment in that I'm actually working. I am working harder than before.
Yeah. Well, I have been, and it may be partly in terms of Corona's effect on certain parts of the world that I sometimes deal with, but partly just coincidence. But I've never been busier, and so as a result, this things like the touted Van Halen episode that we're planning, which I am responsible for pulling together clips in a cohesive way of approaching it, has not happened yet because I have barely had a minute to spare.
But it will happen.
Even if
we end up having to do a very Van Halen Christmas, if that's what we need to do. But we're going to do it because that's something you're passionate about.
Very Van Halen. I have to think about that because we always struggle with a Christmas theme, and why not put them all together?
Why not? Yeah, very Van Halen Christmas. But by extension, this show is going to be a show of which you could say I was passionate about. That's in true. Terms of yes. pulling together clips. We're actually going to discuss the career of Sean Connery shortly, but not Sean Connery James Bond. And what we're going to do is I'm going to recommend to my partner some Sean Connery movies that he may not have seen and that you at home may not have seen. But in light of that, I guess because Sean Connery died and a couple of other people died, and I am now switching to an extremely morbid topic immediately. But I just want to say that yesterday, this show being recorded on the Sunday before you all receive it, someone called the Yorkshire Ripper died in prison. I don't know if you read this, if you saw any of this on the internet. The Yorkshire Ripper was back in the early 80s when I was but a callow teen. The Yorkshire Ripper was a infamous serial killer that terrorized the county of Yorkshire in the sort of middle to north of England, and he murdered about 12 to 13 different sex workers, and it was the sort of thing. Obviously, Britain being a much smaller country, it was the sort of criminal case that completely transfixed a nation. And what is interesting, if you actually look into him, he was eventually caught after murdering over a dozen women. What was interesting was it was one of those cases where the police had interviewed him on four different occasions and it kept releasing him. And even he himself had said when he was finally caught and sent to prison, I can't believe they didn't catch me. And anyway, he passed away in prison just this past weekend. And I don't mean anything by it other than... I would imagine if you grew up in America, when was Son of Sam? Was that in the 60s? Late 70s?
Late 70s.
And then obviously, late 70s. Yeah, and then before that, in the late 60s, early 70s, out in California was the Zodiac Killer. And I would imagine if you are of beyond indeterminate middle age and you live through those things, the Yorkshire Ripper was a was sort of the British correlation of that in terms of it was, you know, any time there was a murder, it suddenly became the headline on the news. And you know, obviously, like any serial killer, it sort of set off this whole cottage industry of interest with biographies and books about inside the hunt for the Yorkshire Ripper. But I will, and the only reason I say this because those real life events were the inspiration for novels by a gentleman called David Pierce, who had written The Damned United. I don't know if you've heard of that book. That was the story about.
I saw the movie.
Yeah. So there, he wrote.
I've been recommending it to people, but you know, because Leeds is back up in the league, so in the Premier League, right? So
yes,
and so I keep saying to people, you know, oh, well, you should go see that movie. Then I'll give you some context on their background.
Well, anyway,
especially young people that have no idea.
The guy who wrote that book, of which that movie was based, he also wrote a trilogy called the Red Riding Trilogy, and it was turned into movies about 15 years ago, with some notable sort of British faces that you'll recognize, including. Sean Bean and I forgot his name now. Andrew, who was the Spider-Man after Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield, and that is a story about police corruption and crime, all set against the backdrop of the Yorkshire Ripper and his criminal activities. But anyway, he passed away this weekend, and I don't mean in any which way to, you know, I'm just we always talk about sort of. Deaths that affected us. And like I say, I remember growing up and I remember that for like two and a half straight years.
I mean, would you say
the leading thing on the newspaper was Yorkshire Ripper strikes or, oh my gosh, are the police closing in on the Yorkshire Ripper? And it was something back in the 80s that completely transfixed a nation.
Well, yeah,
but he died in prison yesterday.
Combine that with the Son of Sam stuff. I mean, it was an era in which, you know, can you imagine that in the current era with the amount of communication, Twitter, texting, and the immediate stuff on your phones? It was more like the news came out through the newspaper or the news broadcast every day. And you're like, ooh, what's happened now? And, you know, I guess Son of Sam was different because they found out who it was during the process. And, you know, it comes out one day that his dog was talking to him as God's voice or whatever it was. There's a lot of weird stuff that would come out each day and you'd be like, what's going on with our world? Little did we know that, you know, the world wasn't going to end until a solid 30 some odd years later.
Yeah. Well, so there's your segue with the Son of Sam being spoken to by God via his dog. You just got two cats.
Yes, we did. We,
there you go. There's a segue away from serial killers to something completely trivial.
We just got a pair of cats. We had a pair of cats before they got old and passed away, you know, of natural causes. But the new cats are blind. And so we have these two blind cats, and we had been looking around the local shout out to Lost Dog and Cat Rescue, which is affiliated with the Lost Dog restaurants in the North Virginia area, which are like sandwich and pizza places. And we were just starting to look. In fact, we were looking at you could borrow a dog for a day, like you could sort of foster a dog for a day. And we're just saying, oh, that might be fun to do and keep them overnight and see what it's all about, because we're thinking about getting new pets. And the other member of the household started perusing the cats and saw these pair of cats. And the cats, although it's through Lost Dog and Cat Rescue, it is a couple that runs sort of it's not a foster business. They have regular day jobs, but they're so active in fostering cats. I forget what number they had, including the cats we were looking at and ended up adopting. They had like seven in the house at the time, which it's not like they had like a whole kennel going in there, but I think they've had something more than 100 cats come through and fostered by them and given out to people. Anyway, they already had a blind cat. And so I think they got picked, you know, they knew the situation with blind cats. And so these two cats, they're 5 months old, and it's Keller and Sullivan, which is named after Ann Keller and Helen Keller and Annie Sullivan, who's her assistant. Sully is a boy, but they go with Sullivan, you know, so we got Keller and Sullivan. Keller is a girl. So we just got them a week ago now.
And how old are they?
5 months.
5 months. Okay.
Yeah. So they're kittens, but they're, you know, pretty decent size already. And they're amazing so far. I mean, they're blind, but you know, it's not very hard for them to get around. You realize, you know, of course, obviously everybody knows cats are, you know, smell and hearing oriented, but they'll sit on the back porch or screened in porch and scan as the birds fly by. Like, not just, you know, they're hearing scratching noises. They can hear the bird flying by over to the bird feeder, and like, really? They're ready to go out there and attack the birds, you know, and they're a ton of fun anyway. But really, I'm sure I'll make a mention of them. The biggest thing about them is they have a bigger social media presence than the Atlantic Voice has ever achieved, and they've only been around for a week.
Yeah, please explain this to me, because when you texted me and said, oh, we can talk about the new cats, and you said they had, was it how many Instagram followers?
They're over 4,000 Instagram followers of their account.
Okay.
And that is really, it's really because of Pokey Pot Pie, which is, oh boy, I don't have it in front of me, but I think it's POKEYPOTPIE, but I'm sure if you search for it on Instagram, they run the foster thing, and then in order to help place the cats, they, you know, they run sort of like sub stories on each of these cats. They have 150 some odd thousand followers.
Oh wow.
And this is just a local DC foster couple, you know, couple that does all these fostering of cats, and you know, people like cats on the internet, and so they had a lot of followers. So when we adopted, they put a little thing out saying, oh, we're so happy that Keller and Sullivan been adopted, and guess what, they've set up an Instagram account, and within 2 hours of us setting it up, we were north of 1,000 people as followers on there. And then over the time, I think as people go and check their Instagram feed, they see that, they sign up, and so we've put up, I don't know how we'll be able to keep up with this, but
I was about to say, you struggle with your schedule to do the show. I don't know how you're going to do social media for two cats.
Well, you know, it's the other member of the household. Oh, okay. More active in posting things. But you know, something up a day, and got lots of nice supportive comments, and people really like the Keller and Sullivan. So, but I, you know, I don't know if we have to put them to work promoting the Atlantic Voice podcast or something. But
well, you might right have now, to, because again, I mean, they're blind, they're not deaf. So we're working in that medium for them.
They do like hearing things. I'm imagining they're going to come down and jump on my lap while we're sitting here doing this.
So if you scream as they dig their claws in, we will know that is Keller and Sullivan's first appearance.
It's fun because they're blind, while, you know, a cat who could see can see what they're going up to easily and will just hop, so to speak. They're much more likely to dig in, like you say, with their claws, because they don't know if, you know, they're heading up 2 feet or they're heading up 10 feet.
And right.
They explore everything vertically, because they can't just go look up and see it. So they climb everything around.
They have to land to figure out the terrain.
Exactly.
When they land, when they've, you know, jumped and arrived.
You so mentioned anyway, you have a cat in your household as well.
Yeah, one of my stepdaughters has got a cat. His name is Rudy. And I
Rudy Giuliani?
No.
Friends of the Four Seasons landscaping?
Well, I mean, he seems to be slightly deranged, running around the house and a lot of quick movements. So maybe he is related to Rudy Giuliani, who's slightly deranged and a lot of quick movements and not really making sense. But I think he's about the same. I think he's about 4 months. But he's already, you know, he's already, like, he's not been done yet. Like, we only took him to get his shots a couple of weeks ago. So he's not been fixed. I don't know. Whenever we talk about that, any adult, you go, oh, he's going to get fixed, as if the cat can understand what's about to happen to him. So he's still in that pre-fixed stage. But he is a regular, you know, he's gray and white. I guess he's a tabby. But he seems to have, but he seems to have an abnormally long tail. And we were having this discussion, because already he is the same size as our dog, but our dog has one of those docked tails. So his tail is like an inch and a half. And I made the observation that Rudy, the cat, has, it seems, an irregularly long and bushy tail. Like, it doesn't seem to fit his body. Mm-hmm. And I was told that that's not the cat. That's just me having got used to the dog having no tail.
Could be. I'll let you know. I
don't know. Maybe over the next couple of weeks, we will probably post pictures of cats on the blog posts.
The real mystery when you told me this news is that your stepdaughter, who has this cat, is just starting college.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Is this the first year or second
year? No, second year.
Second year. I'm not sure how, like, you know.
Yeah, I don't know either.
Did she expect it was going to stay in the dorm, or?
It has been.
Really?
It only arrives in the house, and we're not going to name university in case she gets into trouble. cat's got like a crate.
I was thinking what had happened was, you know.
No, the cat shows up at the house.
But really, you got a cat. But it's only a visitor.
No, well, no, the cat sort of, the cat moves around with her.
Yeah.
And the cat already has some interesting habits in that it eats the dog's food.
Well, and the, I mean.
And the dog has been very intimidated and is kowtowing to the cat.
That's the other thing I was, because you have a small dog.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering how that's going. That's always an interesting introduction. And if the cat comes and goes.
Do you know, they seem to get on, like, you know, they, I think the dog quite likes it. They run around and chase each other and a lot of, you know. So, I mean, because our dog's kind of a wuss, frankly. I mean, he barks a lot and, you know, yaps a big game. But really, he's, you know, he's not very tough. I think he kind of likes it. I think, you know, the fact that she eats or he eats her food.
Mm-hmm.
I'm yelling at the dog like, you can't just let this cat come in and, like, take over. But it would appear that the cat, when the cat is in the house, the cat is the dominant animal personality.
It's kind of what happened to you, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, yeah. So we now, in the house, we have a dog, a cat, and a rabbit. And they're all, the rabbit is incredibly, is pretty big as well. They're all sort of the same weight division. So when they're all out together, it's this interesting sort of, you know, I think it'd be different if you had, like, you know, a rabbit, a cat, and a golden retriever.
Yes.
The retriever or the Labrador or the German Shepherd would naturally sort of be in its own sort of zone because it's so much bigger. But these three are all kind of within a couple of pounds of each other. So it's a sort of animal democracy at work.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. So new cats at the different studios of the Atlantic Voice.
Yeah.
Anything else on animals or dead people?
No, we've gone through quite a bit more than I expected already.
Yeah, so we took care of that.
Get on with the show, so to speak.
Yeah, so on with the show. Sean Connery passed away a couple of weeks ago. And obviously, I was struck by a couple of things. I was struck by how much media coverage it got. I don't know if it was, because it was prior to the, I was surprised, like it would be on the evening news that weekend. And it was like the weekend prior to the election. And I'm like, I don't know.
Don't we have something else going on?
Yeah, there's nothing else going on. And, you know, Sean Connery was 90. And while I think of, I was trying to think of comparisons. And I kept thinking, because he's still alive and he's a couple of years older, I would imagine that when Clint Eastwood eventually passes, that will probably be one of the leads on the evening news.
Yeah.
Because he's an American icon. But I was surprised how Sean Connery, but then I guess at the end of the day, in death, it's James Bond. And it was interesting starting at that moment where Sean Connery and James Bond sort of defined his whole persona.
And he has some big American roles. Like the things you're going to discuss are, I think, are all British. But, you know, you have the Indiana Jones stuff and and the Untouchables are very, not only American products, but a very American movie. So
yes.
It's not like he wasn't a big presence in American cinema and acting as well.
No, it's weird. It's funny because we talked about him the other week when you said you'd watched Zardoz. And again, we're not going to talk about Sean Connery as James Bond because that's been done to death by everyone else. And we've done James Bond anyway. But the whole point of this show, I was going to shout out a couple of movies that I've seen of his that are very good that tend to get completely forgotten. So you've just mentioned The Untouchables. We're not going to talk about The Untouchables in terms of the movie, although I know we will mention these things. But Sean Connery did win an Oscar. I guess that's a big deal.
Was that for him? I don't know what it's for.
He won for The Untouchables.
Okay.
And I think prior to The Untouchables, he'd sort of been in that place in the 90s where he'd not been in too much. And so when he came back, I always think of The Untouchables and him winning an Oscar as sort of the rebirth of like this big third act of Sean Connery's career where he did The Untouchables. And then the next thing you know, he's in The Hunt for Red October. And, because The Untouchables was before he was in Indiana Jones. That came after. I think Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade is either 89 or 90. The Untouchables, I think, is 86 or 87. Because it's also at the start of Kevin Costner's career. And then, of course, you know, he was in The Rock and he was in all kinds of things. I also saw on the internet that apparently he was offered the role of, and you would know the character better than I think the character that Ian McKellen eventually played in The Lord of the Rings. I read somewhere that script, in the way that these scripts go to everyone, that script had gone to Connery and he was very upfront, like it wasn't his thing. And he's like, yeah, I don't know what's going on here. I'm not interested. And so he passed on it to go and do something else. So it wasn't like they were trying to lure him out of retirement. He was just like, yeah, no, this isn't my thing. I have no idea what all these characters and creatures are. But
well,
apparently,
that's going to get into we'll do some of this stuff, and then we'll talk a little bit about him. And, you know, I have mild critiques, but not heavy critiques. Just
you mean of him as an actor?
Not well, kind of, but yeah.
Do you want to start there?
Sure. So the thing, I mean, I thought covering some of the characters, because I watched the trailers you sent. I did not watch the movies, although I do have a lot of deeper background on one of the movies based on the other member of the household, as I think you know.
Yes.
but what was struck by is, as I thought about his career, was it's an oversimplification to say he had limited, you know, dimensions or a one-dimensional character, but so many of his characters are these forceful, robust, fighting, loud kind of characters.
Tough guy.
I can't think of any sensitive or vulnerable type characters he played. I thought about it. I mean, the Indiana Jones is actually closer to that, you know, like in the sense that he was a little bit more subdued and behind, and he wasn't necessarily the leader, but at the same time, he was like a pain in the butt to his son, you know, Harrison Ford in that one. And, you know, Hunt for Red October had a couple moments where he's more vulnerable, Untouchables, not until he's dead. Like, I mean, a lot of it is just, you know, he's the brazen tough guy. And tough guy's too simple of a way to say it, but it's all very out there, and it's not like...
I think you're right. He tended to play sort of very sort of strong, like male. You're right. There aren't many films that he did. And again, I just punched up his
IMDb.
His IMDb, and I'm looking at a couple of things. I think he was, you know, there's a couple of movies in there, Medicine Man, and there's I always think of is it Entrapment? That he was in with, what's her name? Catherine Zeta-Jones, where he was but even then, you know, he's sort of a jewelry burglar, but it tended to be, you know, it's really more sort of a love story type thing. There's is it Finding Forrester? What did he play in that one? Where he is, it's a Gus Van Sant movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like a school teacher or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or he's a writer, but you're right. Those films stand out because they are not the sort of classic Sean Connery sort of strong heroic.
Yeah.
You know,
and that's why I mean, it's a mild, it's not even a critique in the sense of like, it's a flaw. It's just an observation of his arc. And, you know, then again, he's not alone. I want to go ahead and talk about the movies. Cause I think, you know, like the Sir Richard Harris thing is sort of interesting.
So before we get to these movies, I do want to make one last comment. Obviously, you know, and I talked about Clint Eastwood earlier. You know, he's in his 90s. Sean Connery is up there. You know, Robert Redford is getting up there. But ultimately, you know, you look at Connery and he has... what's that thing where you make a point, you're trying to make one point, you end up underlining the opposite of that point by making it?
It's called the Atlantic Voice.
It's called the Atlantic Voice. He's one of those actors. When I look through his filmography, he's done every kind of movie and played like heroes and anti-heroes. The only thing he's never done is any horror, even though he was in a Alfred Hitchcock movie, but that was more of a psychological thriller. But I was surprised. The Zardoz that we spoke about the other week that you caught, this sort of weird fantasy sci-fi. He's got a couple of sci-fi things on his resume, including Highlander. And he's also done
fantasy, right?
He's done historical ones. And he's also done, he also did one Western called Shalako that I think had Brigitte Bardot in it and stuff. So it's interesting. Maybe that's because if you have a career that goes on forever, you end up doing everything. All right. So we're going to do some films in alphabet in chronological order. And let me get, I have a couple of devices going on here. So I wanted to get there. I've got you back on the screen because I've got two computers going. So this first movie, I'm going to play this trailer and then we will talk about it.
The Hill, Sean Connery, bold, exciting, explosive.
See that hill?
Can you voice over this? Or came in.
We built it special. Two tons of sand and rock and a lot of labor and sweat.
What year was this?
1965.
Not you, Roberts. You're going to continue dabbling. Roberts?
Double!
Sean Connery, as you have never seen him before.
On your feet and you listen! No, you listen!
The Hill, a story of men pushed to the breaking point and beyond.
We're both regulars. You'd drop up dead men and inspect them if you was ordered to.
Oh, you quit, eh?
I quit the army, and this is what I think of British justice.
You're going into the commandant dress like this.
All right, so we'll turn that down.
You got a top hat?
Oh, well, sorry.
And a bone to put through me nose.
So we'll turn that down. That movie's from 1965 and it's called The Hill. And you can hear at the start there of that was clearly the original trailer, Sean Connery as you've never seen him before.
So this what do you mean? Just relative to Bond?
Well, that was the thing, because Sean Connery, Bond, he'd been in a couple of things before he became James Bond in 1962. Yeah. But I mean, that was his career. He was James Bond, and he'd become James Bond.
So it's relative to that. I just was thinking in 1965, how much of Sean Connery had anybody seen to be like, I guess you've never seen him before, but it's just really the Bond.
Well, that's the thing. He'd been in a couple of Disney movies. He'd been in some British B movies. He'd been in The Longest Day, which was a film about D-Day, which was a big star-studded film with Robert Mitchum and John Wayne, but he was just another dude in that. But basically, he was James Bond. And so he'd become James Bond as a relative unknown and then had become the biggest star in the world. I mean, I think we tend to, you know, even as a James Bond fan, I think we tend to forget how big those movies suddenly were and how he became an internet. Like, he shot right to the top just because of those movies. Mm-hmm. Like, they at that time, they were like the highest grossing movie of the year, and they would play in the cinema for like 5 months, and Sean Connery would be mobbed everywhere. And so already by 1965, he's only been James Bond for 3 years. He's turned out 3 Bond movies at that time. He was already tired of being James Bond. And so what made this film, The Hill, interesting was a film that, because of being James Bond, He had a bit of influence and he threw his weight around and he said, I want to do this movie. So this is a small black and white movie. And let me just give you a quick rundown of what it's
about. Yeah, I noticed it was black and white. I assume that was for artistic purposes and not reduced cost.
It's a 1965 movie and it is basically about all these soldiers who are in a prison camp. So it's not during the war. So he is a former sergeant major who has been convicted by the military police of
so it's his own prison camp.
Yeah.
He's in a military prison.
A military prison.
For their own military. Right. It's not like captured on the other side.
Yeah, no. So it's not Great Escape.
So in theory, all these people are supposed to be, you know, troublemakers.
Yeah, he basically assaulted his commanding officer and he's gone to prison. And, you know, it's basically a psychological armor. And I'm going to drama.
I mean, to be honest, when I watched it, I thought of, not that it, well, is it Cool Hand Luke-y, you know, like in the sense of, you know, like it's first of all, it's black. Wait, Cool Hand Luke was black and white, wasn't it? No.
No, it's not. Color. But you make, okay. It's Cool Hand Luke-y, but without any of, like, there's no, it's more psychological in terms of, you know, vicious prison guards. And well, it is all about the psychological battle between Sean Connery and a couple of other prisoners.
It's a very different setting in the sense that Cool Hand Luke is a Southern prison, very Americanized.
No, but there are similarities.
That's exactly the face off is like,
right.
You know, you have Newman is, just bucking against the system and like can't be told what to do. And he's just going to pick the fights because he's got this psychological wake up. You know?
Yeah. But there's but it is a much, it doesn't, I want to be careful. Like that is a great comparison, Cool Hand Luke, in terms of the situation and the setup. But I always feel that Cool Hand Luke ultimately is sort of a positive emotional. Do you know what I mean? He's sort of, it's quite funny at times. You know, there's some levity to it. This movie isn't. This is just about a bunch of army guys and brutality in prison. And, I'm going to read straight from the Wikipedia page. So what was interesting was the director of this movie was an American called Sidney Lumet, who Connery worked with on five different occasions. Now, it's only when you get into movies that you start going, oh, Sidney Lumet. Well, Sidney Lumet also worked, the only actor he worked with more than Sean Connery was Al Pacino. So this was the dude that made Dog Day Afternoon and Serpico. This was also the guy that directed Network. And his first movie was 12 Angry Men when he'd worked with all those guys. So what I'm saying was, in the 60s, Connery had suddenly become a star, and then he was able to sort of elbow his way into working with, directors, name directors. And Sidney Lumet was a sort of named artistic director of the 60s and 70s. But anyway, Lumet said about the movie, there isn't a lot of story. It's all character, a group of men, prisoners and jailers alike, driven by the same motive force, fear. So it's a psychological drama. But again, Connery and obviously I recommend all these movies because I'm like, if you watch this for an hour and a half, you're going to go, wow, I've never seen that anymore. That was a good movie. Connery is very much playing against, he is not a particularly nice character in this. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you watch, and it was a great example you made, when you watch Cool Hand Luke, it's Paul Newman. So even though he's in prison, he's Paul Newman. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, and he's, even his character, even though he's bucking the system, everybody likes.
Right.
Like he's the fan favorite there.
Yes. Whereas this movie, Connery is not a particularly likable character.
And Connery probably doesn't eat any eggs in it either. So it's very different that way.
No. So it's interesting how Connery was trying to get away. Like, he is well known during the 60s as getting done with, he was done with James Bond early. He felt like he wasn't getting paid enough. He felt like he never got credit. He felt he was just as important to how big that movie series came. And so he was getting tired of it very quickly and wanted out. And it was interesting that when he did try and do other stuff, like this movie, he's playing, consciously, he is playing characters that are almost the reverse of James Bond. Like, I wouldn't say, compared to the next movie coming up, I wouldn't say he is the villain in this, but he's not very likable. But again, it's a great performance. He's yelling in Scottish, and to your point, he's very sort of macho and tough guy. But
so
it's
speaking
a very
of
good
the
movie.
Scottish part, I didn't know whether to bring that up in this movie or the next one. Obviously, those of us, most American fans are astute enough to kind of pick out a difference between a Scottish and a classic English accent. But what I couldn't tell is listen to his accent. I mean, first of all, he never does without it. Like, has he ever changed? Like, he's never tweaked it or like adjusted I can tell.
He's just like Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
He's interesting. Like, Eastwood just shows up and Eastwood is Eastwood. And he doesn't do an accent. Like, there's one war film where Clint Eastwood is disguised as a German, and yet he's just walking around talking like Clint Eastwood. And I do think he's one of those movies that, you just sort of roll with it. Connery is the same.
So if for people who know, there's sort of different, there's down like poor people's accent, and there's higher and lower levels, certainly in English accents, just like there are in American accents. But like, if you use a train spotting Scottish accent is clearly a different Scottish accent. So I assume, and I don't know for sure, that you would consider Sean Connery's Scottish accent fairly highbrow. Like I don't know if sophisticated is too high a word, but I was trying to figure out if it was out of place. Like in watching that movie and you hear his accent, I mean, maybe part of this is older movies didn't really spend as much time trying to really nail the level of somebody's, accent, and they would just put him out there. I mean, especially the next movie with Richard Harris, you just put Richard Harris in there. Yes. He does his thing. What I didn't know is if you, in that context, would his accent seem a little out of place, because as who he was in the military, should he have been a little down and dirtier, so to speak?
No, I think his accent, when you watch that movie, it's only as he gets older that I think his Scottish accent becomes more sort of sing-songy and sort of warmer. Like, with him yelling there, for the 60s, That was lower to middle. That was a working class Scottish
accent. I was going to say, that's the other thing, is that they've really changed. That's Trainspotting's a bad comparison, in the sense Trainspotting's a very modern version of, like, where it's like, oh my goodness, I can't even tell what they're saying, you know, kind of thing.
But to your point about accents, he is one of those, like, in The Untouchables, he's supposed to be Irish. Yeah, I'm listening to go, this guy's Scottish. Yeah, in exactly. In The Hunt for Red October, he's supposed to be Russian, but he's Scottish. Well, you know, I mean, he's
isn't that one of the movies where they start off with them, they're speaking Russian, but then they just switch them over to English, and then, like, you know.
Yeah, it was always
like at the very beginning, they show it with the closed caption, and then they're like, we're not going to make you all do that.
Yeah.
Here you go. Here's an American version. I mean, English version.
It was actually a very clever way of doing that. Mm-hmm. When they have the dude reading, and then just mid-sentence, he's not reading in Russian, he's reading in English. Exactly. And I'm like, oh, that's really clever, because now we know that really they speak in Russian. But of course, later in the movie, it's like one bookend, but they never bookend it at the other end. Like, at the other, they just keep talking the same. It's not like, you know, Alec Baldwin ever looks at anyone, never looks at Sean Connery and goes, I don't understand what you're saying. So it was
sort of this, like, you know. Just think of all the actors we have in American cinema now that are English, and they just throw away their English accent to do the American roles, you know?
So that's why that is a great segue to this next movie, which I'm now going to hit play for the clip for.
Oscar winner Sean Connery stars in this gritty saga of coal miners fighting for radical change.
But he was an Oscar winner at that point.
We know that he's an organization.
I didn't think he was, no. No, but this is like a modern trailer.
Richard Harris is a gutsy spy determined to sabotage their plans.
Why did you come here?
I came here looking for privacy and breaking my back the same as you.
But he must risk the threat of being exposed and resist temptation of joining their cause.
You'd better be what we think you are.
I'm what you think.
Stand where you are.
You're worried.
They'll be coming after us now. We must be prepared for that.
All right, so a lot of shooting in this.
They won't stop, so we can't stop.
So
these men take.
So a little bit of dialogue there from Sean Connery, and before you say anything, he's supposed to be playing Irish immigrants in Pennsylvania in the late 1800s. Yet I listened to him there. Some dude from Scotland got on the boat and showed up and is hanging out with the Irish Pennsylvanians. This movie's called The Molly Maguires. It was made in 1970. So he was done with James Bond. This was before he had returned for Diamonds Are Forever, which we'll talk about. He's out on his own. He's been away from James Bond for a couple of years. He's trying to establish his career as a leading man. This is, like I say, this is a movie set in the late 1800s in Pennsylvania, and it's about apparently a real group, a real organization who are, I don't know if they were called the Molly Maguires, that's what they're called in the story, but they're a secret organization of coal miners that were involved in sabotaging the coal mines as a way of protesting their work conditions and all this type of thing. And Richard Harris plays an undercover policeman sent from Philadelphia to infiltrate the group and figure out, you know, who the villains are and what they've got going on.
Also arriving with his accent.
Also arriving with his accent. And so you said at the start there about you just get British people into these movies. This has been a long time Hollywood trick. Get British people to play Americans in movies because, A, maybe it's cheaper, or it just makes it all seem more exotic. But it's called The Molly Maguires. It didn't do very well. It is, I don't want to be a spoiler, but I would recommend watching this film. It's a great film. But as I said right there, Richard Harris is the cop. Sean Connery is the villain.
Yeah, so if...
So this is the first movie where Sean Connery, and I talked about that other one just now, The Hill, where he's not really a villain, but he's not very likable. This is Sean Connery being the bad guy. And that's quite rare. Like, I'm trying to think, has Clint Eastwood ever been the villain? I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, he's been unlikable. I'm trying to think if he's been an outright villain. I'm not sure if he has.
Yeah.
But if any of the listeners would think, well, you know, we know Zeff's judgment may be suspect, I can tell you, when I was listening to the trailer of this across the room from the other member of the household, I heard somebody saying, "What are you listening to?" I said, "Well, it's the Molly Maguires." And she's like, "Why are you listening to that?" And I said, because it's going to be on our podcast, is Zeph's a fan of the movie. And she's like, oh my, that's my favorite movie ever. And she just was gushing about it. And we went on and on about, like, it's like one of her all-time favorites. I think she started texting you about it.
Yep.
And then she was particularly like that. There's a, when you go to the YouTube there, one of the first things it brings up after you bring up that is like just the soundtrack, which is like still pictures from the movie. And she said like her and her parents used to listen to the soundtrack to the Molly Maguires on a regular basis.
Well, the soundtrack was by Henry Mancini.
Yeah.
So he was a famous composer from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Did the Pink Panther theme, Touch of Evil with Orson Welles, all kinds of stuff. So
I think we've actually spoken about him before.
I think we have,
Yeah. But in any event, so there's another person who's not Zeph who sings the praises of this movie, if you would care to listen to it. And apparently now I'm going to have to watch it in full at some point and not just the trailer on YouTube.
It's a good movie. It's a very entertaining movie. Like I say, it is ultimately, I don't normally do period stuff. But because it's sort of, you know, it's an undercover cop and it's, you know, coal miners and it's all about, obviously it is sort of Richard Harris, you're sort of figuring out, is Sean Connery the villain and does he kind of have a point type thing?
Right.
Because it's all about, you know, the turn of century, like coal miners angry about their conditions and their pay.
And they had a good reason to be.
Yeah. And again, you know, and I think I want to say this too, you know, while Richard Harris, I wouldn't say Richard Harris was the sort of level star of Sean Connery. He was a relatively big name too. I mean, he was, he ended up so, you know, and funnily enough, talking to Clint Eastwood, he's in Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood.
That's true.
Yeah. So there you go.
I can't remember if he used his British accent there, if he lost it. I don't know if he's ever done something without the accent.
I'm trying to think. I'm not as like hip to Richard Harris's career, but he was very big at the time too. Like he'd been in the musical Camelot, you know, singing and he'd done, I think he was in Lion in Winter. Cause there was also that period around that time where everyone was in movies about like Henry VIII or, you know, that type of thing. But anyway, that movie's called The Molly Maguires. I first saw it. It used to be a staple of like TNT and TBS.
Well, that so you would trailer, find it on late night. That's where that Oscar thing came from, because the trailer, like I remember when I was watching, I was like, well, this doesn't look like a movie trailer. It looks like a TV ad.
It was a video trailer.
It just had the name at the bottom and, you know, that's probably what it was. It's probably from a pre-roll. Like, you know, when you get a tape and they'd have like the movies you should also go see at the beginning of it. That's always, that was always kind of funny. And that's probably what it was. And then by then he had the Oscar win. So they probably put it out there and rolled it out in, you know, a re-release, Criterion release or something.
Yeah, because it used to be the kind of film that would show up on like TBS and TNT at like 11 o'clock at night back in the 90s. And again, it's the type of film that if I start watching it, you know, it's one of those where I'm going to sit and watch it. One, because I like Sean Connery and Richard Harris is very good and it's got very good story, moves along. But anyway, that's The Molly Maguires. So that's another great sort of
step it up through our movies here.
Right. So let me play the next trailer.
So we spent all that time on cats.
Yeah.
Get up.
My hand.
Thank God's
hand. Broken. And I'm
broken, if that's what you're worried about.
Mad, I think you must be.
Mad? You're the one who's mad, Baxter. You won't find me chasing girls across the common, ripping their collars off. You won't find me following girls home from school. Would you like a sweet? You come with me, little girl. I'm coming to show you. I know you.
I think this was the scene where I thought he really plays a forceful person all the time.
Think about her. Won't you look like stripped off? You've got money.
So Sean Connery yelling in his tough guy Scottish accent, he plays a cop basically on the edge from a movie in 1973 called The Offense. And it is basically about a policeman. Have you ever seen him? Obviously, you watched NYPD Blue, right?
Right.
And you know, Andy Sipowicz was sort of the rough and ready cop hitting people with phone books and breaking all the rules. Do you know what I mean?
But and then the guy from The Shield. What was The Shield?
Right.
What was the movie?
The Shield was the TV series. Yeah. Michael Chiklis, the only guy to be the commissioner and The Shield.
It's the cop who's, you know, driven to the point where they're, you know, just out of control. But you're
just out of control.
There's a vengeance to it.
This was another movie. This is called The Offense. It was another movie he did than Sidney Lumet. And again, it's about a policeman trying to...
Is this one set in the United States or England?
What, the offense?
Yeah.
No, it's set in England. But because I've lived here so long, I'm not sure if it's the offense or the offense. I can't tell. I think it's the offense. Here's what's interesting about this movie was, when Sean Connery came back to be James Bond in Diamonds Are Forever, that was after the other guy had been James Bond, he wanted to be paid, but he also... And Sean Connery was known as... frugal is the wrong word, but he didn't like being ripped off. So he was he'd drive a hard bargain in terms of being paid. But what he said, I'm going to come back and do your James Bond movie, even though I'm done with James Bond, because you're going to make loads of money. But what you're going to do is you're going to foot the bill for three movies of my choice.
Oh.
And this was the first one that he did. And so he got Sidney Lumet back in to direct. The movie didn't do very well. And that kind of deal to fund three movies kind of just fizzled out. But it's... Again, it's another movie where he is not particularly likable, but it's some terrific acting. You're watching this guy kind of melt down. You're sort of rooting for him a little bit because he is a policeman, and yet you're like, bro, you kind of can't do that type thing. But again, very, very good movie, terrific performance. And again, Sean Connery playing the opposite of his established, stereotyped screen persona. Again, he spent a lot of the 60s and 70s trying to run away from being a traditional leading man. And that was what was so notable when you talk about The Untouchables and then Indiana Jones. That's when he sort of re-embraced this notion of being a heroic character. He's not really a hero in this movie. He's the bad guy in the Molly Maguires. He's not very likable in The Hill. And so it's interesting.
That clip, we didn't play it through to the end, but the caption on YouTube and then the very last line is the guy who's under interrogation. What do you call him? You little insignificant man or something like that. There's an insult at the end of it where it suddenly turns the table. And I was trying to figure out, is that just happens to be the way that scene goes? Or is in fact, like, does somehow this criminal get the upper hand on him? And
he does. It comes towards, I'm not going to give it away, but it comes towards the climax of the movie.
Okay.
He has finally tracked down the person he believes to be the killer, and he has him one-on-one in the interrogation.
Okay. It looked pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So he was wearing one of those cool sheep shearling suit jackets. You know,
yeah, like Kramer used to wear in Seinfeld. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. All the rage. Let's get on with this next one. And this is not a trailer. This is a clip.
And now, sir. Let me introduce you to Brother Peachy Carnahan, which is him, and Brother Daniel Dravot, which is I. The less said about our professions, the better, for we have been most things in our time. We've been all over India. We know her cities, her jungles, her jails, and her palaces. And we have decided that she isn't big enough for such as we.
Yes, that's what I understood the commissioner to say.
Therefore, we are going away to another place where a man isn't crowded and can come into his own. We're not little men, so we're going away to be kings. Kings of Kafiristan.
Oh, Kafiristan.
We hear they have 32 idols there, so we'll be the 33rd and 34th.
It's a place of warring tribes, which is to say, a land of opportunity for such as we, who know how to train men and lead them into battle.
We'll go there. We'll say to any chief we can find, do you want to vanquish your foes? Of course, you'll say, go to it. We'll fight for him, make him king, then we'll subvert that king. We'll seize his royal throne and loot the country four ways from Sunday.
Sean Connery and Michael Caine in The Man That Would Be King. And again, he's supposed to be an English army officer. That's gone out the way, British army officer. He's just playing Sean Connery's Scottish accent. Michael Caine's actually making an effort to not talk like Michael Caine.
I know that when he says other.
Yeah. And then the other person in that clip who only had a couple of words was Christopher Plummer, who is playing Rudyard Kipling, because it's based on a Rudyard Kipling story. And then when they did the movie version, it's a Rudyard Kipling short story, but they insert Rudyard Kipling in as Rudyard Kipling. And it's basically it's a buddy movie. Sean Connery and Michael Caine are two army officers who are out of the army, but are still in India at the turn of the century. And they basically end up in this small corner of the continent, and they're able to fool the local people that they are in fact gods. And Michael Caine wants to get in there, get some money, and get on out. But Sean Connery's character starts to believe that, well, maybe I am a god to these people. So why not stay and be a god? And it's, like I say, it's an old Rudyard Kipling story. And it's the man who would be king.
I was going to say, you know, based on that scene, they do not seem like good people.
No, they're kind of hustlers.
They're out in the army. At the time, that being sort of, oh, it's funny like this. But I don't think that as a plot would sell today.
No, but they were rogues. Do you know what I mean?
But they were supposed to be like, well, like, you know, as an audience member, you weren't supposed to hate them, right?
No, you're supposed to like
them. But I think in the modern sensibility, that would be a fairly hateful enterprise, yes. You know, colonialism, even if it happened in the past.
So Michael Caine has always said that Michael Caine and Sean Connery and Roger Moore were all very good friends in real life. And they had constantly looked for things to do together. And I know Roger. Can you hear me? Yeah, you go. Roger Moore.
You're off now.
Am I back? I'm back now. Yes, you can hear me now. Roger Moore and Sean Connery never got a chance to work together, but Michael Caine and Roger Moore did. Yeah. But this was the chance. Caine was like, I'll do this if Sean's going to do it. And they decided to do it together because they were big pals off screen. Michael Caine has said it's the best acting I've ever done of himself. But here's what's interesting about this movie. And I want to say this, and I want to pick on the point you've just made about, ooh, these characters could be uncool if we were doing it now. The script had bounced around Hollywood for a couple of years. John Huston, the great director, had tried to put it together before. He'd originally asked Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas to do it, but their schedules didn't clear up. Then he tried to get Richard Burton and Peter O'Toole to play the two characters. And then he ultimately, because this was after Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, he talked to Redford and Paul Newman to be the two characters. And Newman said to Huston, look, this is good, but you know something? You really need to get, this is about British Army dudes and India. You should really get Brits to do it. But so to your point, do you know what I mean? Yes, they are roguish characters, but because of the era it was made in, it's actually, you know, it's a very sort of classic sort of period piece. It's very funny at times. It's a very entertaining film. And it's one that sort of gets lost a little bit because it's not really, you know, it's not so much. While it's set in India and they're army guys, it's not a war movie. It's basically about two hustlers. And it's a really good film. And again, it's Connery. It's
the prequel to Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Yeah, but not quite as funny as Dirty Rotten.
Michael Caine, you know.
Michael Caine, and I guess, what does that mean, that Steve Martin is playing the Sean Connery character?
It's a sequel, so he's playing a different character when you couldn't get the other guy.
All right, so one more film on my list of Sean Connery movies. And this is obviously, this last one is a film that people probably would have seen. So we've had Connery play villains, we've had Connery play not so nice characters. In that last one, Connery's character goes a little bit crazy. Let's just put it that way.
All right.
So let's play this last clip.
General Browning will be down right away, sir. He wondered if you perhaps might like to change.
Change?
Your clothes, sir.
Oh, thanks.
You want to tell people what's going on?
Sorry, no, because the other characters walk. I'd forgotten when I...
No.
Yeah, in fact, when you sent this, you said to start at minute one, didn't you?
Oh, you... I'm not sure that I'll know for a while. But I'm sorry about the way it worked out.
You did all you could.
Yes. But did everyone else?
They've got a bed for you upstairs if you want it.
I took 10,000 men into Arnhem. I've come out with less than 2. I don't feel much like sleeping.
I've just been on to Monty. very proud and pleased.
Pleased?
Of course. Ethics Market Garden was 90% successful.
But what do you think?
Well, as you know, I've always thought that we tried to go a bridge too far.
Sean Connery playing a real person, Major Urquhart, I think is, was it Major Urquhart or Colonel Urquhart? A real person involved in an operation after D-Day called A Bridge Too Far. True story. And a star-studded movie that basically tells the tale of an Allied mission after D-Day to drop paratroops into Belgium and Holland and take control of five bridges. And it's so multifaceted. It's got, so it sort of shows, let me just name some of the people who are in it. The other voice you heard there was Dirk Bogarde, a famous British actor from that era. James Caan, Michael Caine, Edward Fox, Elliot Gould, Anthony Hopkins, Gene Hackman, Hardy Kruger, Laurence Olivier, Ryan O'Neill, Robert Redford, Maximilian Schell, and Liv Ullmann. There is your cast for a big 3-hour blowout type.
It's like Ocean's 11.
Yeah, but without the jokes. And again, you know, it's interesting. There are some actors, and I'm gonna tell a story. I'm gonna tell a bit of trivia from this movie. So this was directed by Sir Richard Attenborough, and he had approached Steve McQueen to be in it, and McQueen was interested. And then when McQueen saw that there were so many other stars in it, he was like, "Why would I want to be in a movie where I'm not the man?" So McQueen turned it down, and his part went to Robert Redford, who was more than happy to show up. Because again, because there are so many actors and so many characters and so many storylines, no one actor carries the movie. But to be fair, Connery is in it for a large chunk at a time. And basically, he's the dude in charge of the British forces who takes, as he says there in that clip from the end of the movie, "I took 10,000 men in and I've come out with 2,000. It's all about a failed, you know, the Anthony Hopkins group gets stranded at the bridge and they're all trying to get him back. And in the process, while the mission is 90% a success, by going the extra step, it's a massive failure and all kinds of Brits and the American and Polish forces all get slaughtered. But a very good war movie and a big war epic. And I think it's one of, again, it came from like 1977. So Connery was sort of in that mid-range of his career. This is before The Untouchables. This is after James Bond. He's basically just, you know, doing stuff, being in movies. Yeah. And this was like a very big budget movie of the 70s that he ended up in.
Yeah, that one I had a harder time like following, because the trailer, obviously a movie like that is kind of hard to capture what it is, whereas the other movies I had a sense of what was going on, and this one I was like, I know of this movie.
So you've never seen it?
No.
No, and like I said, it's one of those, it's like 2¾ hours, but it is one of those films, if you watch it at the start, you will get sucked in, because again, it's multiple actors, multiple storylines. I wouldn't say, it's not a documentary, but it's very straight-laced in terms of you're trying to capture all these things, you know. Had a massive budget because back in the 70s, you know, if you wanted to film, you know, 5,000 people parachuting, you had to find 3,000 dudes and make
well,
them jump.
True.
Out.
Yeah. If it's a film of 5,000, you can get by with 3,000, but you couldn't CGI everybody in after off 100.
But again, you know, while Connery is one of many, he has a very big part in the movie. You know, paying a very, you know, sort of stiff upper lip British general, obviously with his slight Scottish burr of an accent. But again, it's a movie that doesn't, you know, it's weird. Despite that all-star cast, it's a movie that you don't see a lot on. You might sort of find it in sort of the backwoods of cable one evening or something like that at like 11 at night. And yet, you know, I just read all those names and I'm like, yeah, this is a big blockbuster movie from the 70s. But those are five Sean Connery films that I don't think get enough love that people should watch. The Hill, The Molly Maguires, The Offense or The Offense, a Bridge Too Far, and whatever the other one was.
The
Man Who Would Be King.
I think I'm definitely going to put on The Molly Maguires because I'll be forced to by the other member of the household, and The Man Who Would Be King. I think both those are most intriguing. The Hill maybe, but that might be a sit around and watch it by myself kind of thing. I'm not sure that I'd get the other.
But here's the interesting thing about Sean Connery. You know, when you go to his filmography, you know, he's got James Bond, and then we all remember him, you know, that run of pictures starting with The Untouchables and, you know, Indiana Jones and Hunt for Red October and even The Rock, which I watched bits of the other day, which I don't like as a movie, but I love watching him in it. And yet people forget there's 20 years in between of work that he did that doesn't get enough attention. Mm-hmm. I mean,
he's around a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I've got his filmography open right now. There's the obviously After the Man Who Would Be King. He was in a Robin Hood movie, Robin and Marian. He was in The Wind and the Lion, which was like some sort of epic in the Middle East, a costume drama type thing. I've always got a soft spot for Outland, where he plays the sheriff on sort of sci-fi. It's basically a ripoff of High Noon, but he plays a sheriff on like a mining colony out in Jupiter or something. Then he came back to do James Bond, Never Say Never Again. The Highlander, obviously, him and Christopher Lambert. What is it? I am Highlander. Is he the one who yells that line?
I can't remember. I mean, you know, that I've seen, but it's, you know, just a big mishmash of late nights and stuff.
Yeah. Name of the Rose. He was in the Robin Hood movie with Kevin Costner, where Kevin Costner is Robin Hood. Talk about people not doing their accents.
Yeah, yeah.
He was in Rising Sun, the Michael Crichton story about the murder of the girl in the Japanese business tower. Wesley Snipes is in that. It was a Michael Crichton book. First Night, The Rock, obviously, Entrapment. And also, movie I forgot, which almost made the list, he's in Time Bandits.
Oh yeah,
the Monty Python movie. Yeah. So again, those are the five Sean Connery films and performances that you probably haven't seen that I recommend to you.
All right. Well, I back you up on this. They seem like good choices. I'm a little suspect sometimes of your things, but these are good.
No, they're good. Good movies. So yeah, don't just watch like an old James Bond over the next couple of weeks. Try and
You're all going to have time at Thanksgiving because you're not going to be going to visit your family and stuff. And so you'll be everybody sitting at home making your own small turkeys.
Small turkeys.
Better go to the store fast because apparently you won't be able to find a small turkey anywhere.
Yeah, but you can just buy a turkey breast.
It's not like turkey.
Are you going to cook a turkey?
I'm hoping to smoke one.
There you go. You know? Yeah. So I think that's it for this show. We are still going to the Van Halen show, the Van Halen appreciation show will still appear. And basically what's going to happen is my partner is going to educate me on Van Halen. And I'm going to ask questions about that. But that is coming up. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything else.
Nope. I think that covers it.
No, this has been the Atlantic Voice podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at Libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at AtlanticVoice.net. Email us at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.